This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, biological weapons, what they do to humans and the environment. We hear from Harvard Molecular Biology Professor Meselson. The bald eagle has been restored in New York State. We find out how it was done and hike along the Hudson River looking for some. Uncertainty and disputes over land ownership lead to bloodshed in Mexican forests. We go to Chihuahua, where the trees are falling. And in the Earth calendar, skunk sex in California. It's that time of year. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. In recent weeks, the United States has made it clear it will go to war, if necessary, to prevent Saddam Hussein from developing chemical and biological weapons. Chemical weapons, like mustard gas deployed in World War I, and more recently developed nerve gas, attack the body directly, while biological agents such as anthrax and botulinal toxin cause sickness or infection. Dr. Matthew Meselson is a professor of molecular biology at Harvard University. He's long been involved in research relating to biological weapons, analyzing how they can be detected and how they affect humans and the environment. He talks about the effects of anthrax.
The anthrax is a living bacterium, but it's not contagious from person to person, so it would not start an epidemic. But the spores of anthrax can remain in the soil for decades, but this is unlikely to be as big a threat as the natural threat of anthrax. Anthrax still claims thousands of animal lives all over the world every year. And when an animal dies of anthrax, unless the carcass is disposed of properly, you create a new focus in the ground. And it's this environmental hazard which causes the disease to keep cropping up in many parts of the world.
Professor Meselson comments on the secondary environmental damage of anthrax.
I think that we aren't dealing with a major environmental threat as compared with the direct damage. That is, if we mean the unintended damage, I think the intended damage is likely to be, if these things are ever used, more severe.
Antidotes to biological warfare include vaccination and physical protection such as gas masks. Meselson traces what happens if one is exposed.
If you do contract anthrax, there are three different routes of infection that are well known in humans. On the skin, it can, if it enters through a wound, a cut on the skin, it can cause cutaneous anthrax, which is usually not lethal, causes a dark-looking sore, and it can be treated with antibiotics. And even if not treated with antibiotics, it's seldom lethal, although it can be. Then, if you eat a large quantity of anthrax spores from a, for example, contaminated animal, then you could get gastrointestinal anthrax, which has a much higher rate of fatality. And finally, if you inhale anthrax spores and your normal bodily defenses don't protect you, and they're pretty good at protecting you, but if you inhale enough spores, they fail, then that disease is very rapidly fatal. And it can be treated with antibiotics, but only if antibiotic treatment is begun very soon, preferably very soon after the initial inhalation.
Biological warfare is frightening in part because of the unknowns, and also because the use of biological weapons can be difficult to prove. Once developed, biological agents are inexpensive to manufacture. Moreover, new science is expanding the range of weapons that could be developed. Meselson describes how he looks at biological research and its application in the future.
Every technology that humans have developed, from stonework through metallurgy, through the, if you want to take a big jump, the internal combustion engine, explosives, electronics, computers, nucleonics, has been exploited not only for good, but also for hostile purposes. Now, the next really big technology, maybe the biggest of all, is going to be biotechnology. We can just see this beginning now. But in the coming century, we're going to learn enough about the life processes to be able to manipulate all of them, including cognition, metabolism, development, reproduction in any way that you can imagine. It will be possible to repattern the human body. It will be possible to reprogram the human mind. The potentials of this technology for human betterment are, of course, vast. But if exploited for hostile purposes, the potentials not only for destruction, mass destruction, but also for subjugation and exploitation are also enormous. It seems to me that this is the time, before it started, to say, wait, this is a brand new problem. It's not a problem for any one country only. This is a species problem. We're talking about Homo sapiens. This is the time to sit back and think imaginatively about how we avert the intensive exploitation of biotechnology for hostile purposes.
Professor Meselson suggests that we need to develop an international criminal court and body of international criminal law by which individuals will be held accountable for the use or application of biological agents for hostile purposes. He says biological weapons have the potential of changing the nature of international conflict. For example, one nation might try to cripple another by causing a drastic reduction of agricultural production. This could occur without the target country even knowing what was happening. From the time people began inhabiting North America, we've admired bald eagles. They've been an important part of Native American culture, and their grace and beauty are described in song and poetry. But after European settlers arrived on the continent, bald eagle populations began declining, and by the 1960s, the animal was in danger of extinction. Now, because of pesticide bans, successful reintroduction programs, and the preservation of critical habitats, the bald eagle has made a comeback. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on one area where our national emblem is making a resurgence.
For years, the Hudson River Valley has been the home of bald eagles and important wintering grounds for hundreds of the birds that migrate south each year from Canada. In the early and mid-1800s, people often made the short trip north from New York City to watch dozens of bald eagles as they rode chunks of ice floating down the Hudson River. For many of the Gilded Age, it became a Sunday afternoon outing. But by World War II, bald eagle populations were already beginning to decline. Peter Nye is unit leader of the Endangered Species Division for New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation. He says while the pesticide DDT did play a role in the decline of bald eagle populations, it had a smaller impact than is commonly believed.
By the time DDT was produced for the first time, it really came out as a product of World War II. It wasn't used heavily until the 1950s and 60s after World War II. Bald eagles in New York and probably throughout the nation were probably about 80% of their historic numbers already. So you have to ask yourself, well, what was it that really affected bald eagles? And there was some indiscriminate killing and some trapping and things like that. There were conflicts with people killing eagles, but I think on a grander scale, really it was habitat loss and alteration that affected bald eagles. People simply moving into the areas that they used, up and down the Hudson River that was used as a tremendous corridor for industry and trade. People were everywhere. The landscape looked nothing like it looks currently today.
By the 1970s, there was only one breeding pair left in all of New York State, and that couple was non-productive because the female was so contaminated with DDT. It appeared that the bald eagle was headed for extinction. But with the passing of the Endangered Species Act in 1973, federal monies became available that could help. New York became one of the early states that took part in endangered species management. With the assistance of experts, Peter Nye helped develop a plan to raise eagles through a process known as hacking.
They would be placed in an 8-foot by 8-foot cage, about 6 foot high. There would be an artificial nest built for them. They'd be placed in the nest. It was blocked off completely except in the front. So the front would direct them into the habitat that we chose. They would see beautiful lakes and perch trees, and there'd be perch poles going right out of the cage. And on the backside, it was all one-way glass or permanent closure. And we could get up as site attendants and get on the back of the cage, never being seen, just quietly open up a one-way door, put fresh fish in it, close the door. That would drop into the cage, and they would then feed themselves.
The method was a success, and in the first 5 years of the program, 2 to 4 birds were released a year. The program was expanded, and 20 to 30 birds were released annually during the next 8 years. The reintroduction program has helped restore bald eagle populations in New York State. 10 years ago, less than 6 bald eagles would be spotted along the Hudson River Valley in January. Today, at least 30 use the River Valley as wintering grounds, with the number reaching 300 statewide. About 35 breeding pairs of bald eagles are calling New York State home year-round, with plenty of younger eagles traveling about. Peter Nye believes the state could support more.
But we'll start to begin to understand when we've reached that kind of plateau, when eagles are nesting in kind of ridiculous areas. You know, they're in places where they're being disturbed constantly. They aren't producing young. They're getting blown off their eggs early, things like that. They'll be in secondary or tertiary quality habitats, and they simply won't be able to exist. But I think we're a long way from that, particularly when you look at the larger northeast region. I think there's a lot of capacity for eagles. The Hudson in itself, as I said, now we know of 3 breeding sites. I just discovered a brand new one in January of this year. I think that could hold at least a dozen to 15 nesting pairs along the Hudson.
The immatures, the first-year immatures, are very dark. They have little white on them.
That's Christopher Letts, an educator with the Hudson River Foundation. He and Tom Lake hold Eagle Watch programs on George's Island Park, located in Westchester County. It's about 25 miles north of New York City, right on the Hudson River. Hundreds of people gather for the informative programs held in January and February. Now that the bald eagle is making a comeback, people are again coming out to see the majestic bird, much like they did earlier this century. Tom Lake, who also puts together the Hudson River Almanac, says you can see a variety of bald eagle behaviors on any given winter day.
So we're standing around here lamenting that we're not having a harsh winter, because with a harsh winter comes ice, and ice flows on the river, and it's like going to a Broadway play. You can stand here at George's Island and look out on the river, and it's as if they're choreographing an event for you. You'll see adults pair, they mate for life for the most part, adult bald eagles, and you'll see the bald eagles in ritual displays of courtship. You'll see immature eagles on an ice floe with an adult, and the adult will be feeding on a fish, and here's the immatures prancing in a circle around the adult, jumping up and down, having a temper tantrum because the adults won't share with the young eagle.
Lake says their feathered white feet look like rodeo chaps, making the birds appear almost comical. But the historical relationship between humans and bald eagles is not so funny. Even though humans drove the bald eagle to near extinction, there is still a certain respect we have for the bird, and in some ways, the bird in relation to mankind.
For example, we had a program here almost 2 weeks ago, and we had a bald eagle who sat and looked at us several hundred feet away for an hour or more, took off, came back, and sat on the same limb and eating a gizzard shad. And it was a beautiful experience. It was a light snowfall was coming down, and you look through the spotting scope, and here's the eagle, the adult, feeding on a fish. And it easily could have been a travel brochure for an Alaskan cruise.
The day I went to George's Island Park was a balmy winter day, almost spring-like. Unfortunately, no bald eagles were spotted. But for me, looking out over the Hudson River, it's just enough knowing that they're there and doing well. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production, and funding for coverage of the Mexico forest is provided by the Fund for Investigative Journalism and the KUNM Producers Fund. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. I'm sure you have ideas about the environment. Share them with us. Our telephone number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. You can email us at green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Despite moves towards privatization, three-fourths of Mexico's forests are located on communally owned land. But conflicts are breaking out as protesters voice their opposition to government involvement in the forest areas. This is turning some lands into political and physical battlegrounds. In the last of a series, Kent Patterson reports.
The streets of Chihuahua, Mexico, were transformed into a battlefield last spring as clubs cracked and rocks flew between police and indigenous residents from the Tepehuan community of Monterrey. The Tepehuanis had traveled hours from their collectively owned forest land, known in Mexican law as an ejido. They were protesting the management of the ejido by an administrator who had allegedly embargoed their machinery and property.
El problema era que jerárquicamente no es posible que se hayan.
Luz Castro served as a legal advisor to the Monterrey protesters. She was tossed into a vehicle by the police and held overnight with dozens of others.
Bueno, me detuvo junto con más de 70 indígenas.
I was detained along with more than 70 indigenous people and taken to the Office of Preliminary Investigations, where we spent the whole night in detention. There were many injured indigenous people there, full of blood, who weren't receiving medical attention. There were many people with bloody head wounds and many indigenous people who didn't understand because they don't speak Spanish and they didn't have translators.
The Monterrey incident sparked one of the major political crises in Chihuahua in recent years. Because of the violence, the official State Human Rights Commission issued three non-binding recommendations to Chihuahua Governor Francisco Barrio. They included the firing of the state police chief, who stayed in office in spite of the commission's recommendation. Commission President Eliodoro Juarez acknowledges the police used disproportionate force against the demonstrators. On a broader level, the Monterrey incident highlighted a widespread problem in rural Mexico, conflicts over the ownership and control of forest lands.
Cuando se vende a tocón, incluso está por abajo de los 100 pesos.
In other parts of Mexico, including the southern state of Guerrero, conflicts abound between forest ejidos over land ownership boundaries. Severo Oyarzabal is the president of the Supreme Council of the Peoples of the Filo Mayor, an independent organization that claims to represent 30,000 residents of the southern Sierra Madres. He says disputes between towns sometimes break out in violence.
What's happening is that since the forest doesn't belong to anybody, the two towns that are in conflict are finishing each other off. They're smuggling the wood, taking it out, and cutting it up. They're doing many things and finishing off with the forest because of the problem over land ownership.
Cuando ya lo empiezas a vender.
In the neighboring state of Oaxaca, violent feuds also continue over ownership of the forest. According to a 1996 report by the nonprofit group Minnesota Advocates for Human Rights, dozens have died in recent years in fights over these timber-rich lands. Earlier in the 1970s, an armed guerrilla insurgency arose in part because of the land battles. Back in the north, Luz Castro predicts future conflicts in the state of Chihuahua, where a $300 million tourist development project could put additional pressures on the use and ownership of forest ejido lands.
Bueno, porque desde luego que para ponerlo, por ejemplo, para poner una autopista, se tiene que...
In order to put in a highway, for example, they have to cut down part of the forest. And to make way for the big hotels and sports of the tourist industry that they want to put in, they also have to expropriate or buy the ejidos in which the people live. That doesn't take into account the authentic owners of the lands, who are the indigenous people. They only take into account the businessmen and transnationals who see a gold mine.
Currently, the Mexican government is promoting greater foreign investment in the forestry industry. But until management and ownership issues are cleared up, foreign participation is likely to aggravate existing conflicts and create new ones over control of the land and its resources. I'm Kent Patterson reporting.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. In California, it's mating season for skunks, that special time of year when males go looking for romance. Cindy Dickey is assistant of Wild Care Wildlife Rehabilitation Center in Marin County, California. She says courtships between skunks often become volatile.
Well, this is the season, and we've seen some matings, and it's also the only season when actually you can both hear and see skunk quarrels when males get a little bit get a little fast with the females. Skunk mating is sort of like cat mating, and so the male will make an approach, and if the female's not ready, then they have a more or less vigorous squabble when they make these little clattering sounds and, you know, faint at each other and sometimes even spray. But when the female's receptive, then it just goes easily.
Its unmistakable markings and pungent defensive spray are probably the skunk's most distinguishing characteristics. They're very active this time of year in southern states as well as California, so it's best to steer clear of the love-crazed polecats because they can spray an enemy with accuracy from a distance of 10 feet. Skunks live about 2 to 4 years, but other than a once-a-year mate, Cindy Dickey says males and females don't spend a bunch of time together.
The males are solitary for the rest of the year. The females are actually quite chummy all fall and winter long. They'll have burrows where you can find, you know, 4 or 5 females, you know, all sleeping together. But the males are often in some hollow log by themselves until mating season.
Skunks are born about 65 days after their parents mate. The average size litter is about 5. Adults reach a length of between 22 and 32 inches, with females being about 15% smaller than the males. While many of us complain about skunks getting into our garbage or spraying our dog or cat, Cindy Dickey says they're good to have around.
I mean, if you've got skunks in your neighborhood, they're eating more than 50% of their diet is bugs. And they're also eating... they're omnivores, you know, pieces of rotting fruit, and they're excellent mousers. So they're very beneficial. And one of the favorite things that I have seen a skunk do is I have a Bartlett pear tree, and the fruit was just falling, and it was windfall season, and a skunk found out about them, and I had this skunk that would come every evening just before dark, and he was so glad that he was getting these pears. He actually sort of moved like Pepe Le Pew. He did these bounds through the tall grass as he was coming towards the pears, and he really, as far as I could tell, looked like a very happy animal.
So if you happen to see a French-speaking skunk that's eating a pear and goes by the name of Pepe, ask him if he knows Cindy Dickey, then call us. Of course, we'll believe you. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, author Tyler Volk explores the interaction of organisms on the Earth. He says he looks into the guts of the planet itself. We talk green about how and whether the chemical industry has cleaned up its act. And in anticipation of spring, we hear a fly fisherman's portrait of the Battenkill River in Vermont, where the trout are elusive at all times of year. Stay with us. New York University biology professor Dr. Tyler Volk has written a book titled Gaia's Body, Toward a Physiology of Earth. The Gaian theory emphasizes the notion that the Earth itself is a living organism with many different parts. But Dr. Volk, who has worked with NASA in the past on artificial environments, says he sees Gaia as a global metabolism, not a global organism. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott recently spoke with him about the impacts that one particular animal is having on the entire system.
What role do humans play in all of this? They're part of the living sector, but obviously their impact is far greater than perhaps many other species. What role do humans play?
The role of humans, it's from one sense, we would be just part of the guild of respirers. We take organic matter and we turn it into carbon dioxide and we use up some oxygen in the process, just to simplify one of the chemical functions that we perform. So in that way, we're like all the other respirers on the planet. However, we're making such a big impact on the planet that in my book, Gaia's Body, I claim that the human should be considered a new biochemical guild. For one, we're taking fossil fuels out of the ground and using it as an energy source. So, and that becomes carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere. And in that way, we are doing something new biochemically. Even though it's carbon dioxide that's going in, that is not new. The fact that we're taking the fossil fuel and turning it into carbon dioxide is a new kind of chemical transformation.
Do you think that population is the biggest environmental factor today in terms of the global environment, or do you think that that population is a big part, but there are many other significant elements? How do you see it?
Okay, I do. The first thing that came to mind when you said that, I was going to name two: the greenhouse effect and population. Of course, the greenhouse effect is tied to population, so they're not completely independent. But then, as you were talking, I was realizing, yes, it's population is a big problem. However, from studies, when I'm in contact with people, population experts, there's not a lot we're going to do about population for at least a few decades until changes in fertility that are happening in various countries really start manifesting themselves over decades, because the children that are already there are growing up in countries with certain kinds of ethics for having more children, and those are changing, but it takes some time to change. So the population projections, if you look at the United Nations population projections of low, medium, and high, they're virtually the same for the next few decades. And so we're going up to 8 billion probably, you know, for sure. Hopefully we're not going to go too much beyond that, but it's that's almost a given. And even though we can consider it a problem, it's almost a given. Now you have to think, what's the impact of each person on the environment? Well, some of my work with NASA, if we were able to come up with recycling systems for the astronauts on Mars, some of these technologies might be able to be used on Earth. I mean, what if communities spewed out much fewer pollutants into the environment because they were closing all the loops? Sort of like a good ecosystem doesn't want to let the phosphate out of it. Well, what if we were closing our loops? What if all our cars were made so that they could be dismantled and easily recyclable?
The theme that every living thing is interconnected or connected is not necessarily a new idea. What then is unique
about your book or some of the things that you talk about in your book that that perhaps provides a different angle on that?
I think I've put together life's impact and life's role in these global cycles better than anybody has before. I've been working on these scientifically, publishing detailed papers in the journals for about 15 years, and I decided to write a book for the general public on the physiology of Earth, on Gaia's body, explain how this body works, explain what the organs are, explain what the interconnections between the organs are. And yes, we know it vaguely, or it's in the air, the interconnection of everything, but I think it's valuable to really have some of the look into some of the guts, so to speak, of the planetary system. And really my focus is on life. There's many books out on climate and the greenhouse effect, but I'm really concerned with organisms and how they have affected the atmosphere both today and through Earth's history and oceans and soil. So I think at the end of the book, readers gain a vision of the planetary system that when they take a walk through the woods, when they go into their backyard garden and they think about their plants in their garden connected to the bacteria under the oceans of Antarctica, when they look out and take a walk in the Adirondack Mountains, look out at the forests and see those forests and think about the different operations those forests are having with the atmosphere and how the atmosphere circulates to the forests in Siberia, I hope that people will gain some visions from this book that they can take with them in their daily experiences with nature.
That was Professor Dr. Tyler Volk talking about his new book titled Gaia's Body, Toward a Physiology of Earth, published by Springer Verlag, New York, Inc. We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. After the Love Canal crisis, when the effects of dumping waste by the Hooker Chemical Company into what became a residential area, and after the Union Carbide chemical plant spill in Bhopal, India, which released toxic fumes that both killed people and created a large number of injuries, the Chemical Manufacturers Association, which is the group that works as a association for all of the manufacturers, adopted a program which was called Responsible Care. And when they did that, almost 10 years ago, it was regarded as one of the first industry codes of environmental conduct and represented an effort by the companies to bring all of their colleagues up to an acceptable level of environmental performance. And it was also regarded by many as a means of getting industry activity that would preclude or make unnecessary further or more heavy-handed government regulation. So the program is now about 10 years old, and the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or USPIRG, which is an environmental organization, has taken a look at the program, and they say it hasn't lived up to expectations. So the question is the chemical industry, or if you live next to a chemical plant, is the plant in your neighborhood doing enough to protect the environment? And we'd like your views. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two guests with me. Allison LaPlante is the program associate at the USPIRG, and she's a co-author of the PIRG report on the Responsible Care Program. She's in Washington. And Jim Sollist, who is Senior Director of Regulatory Improvement for the Chemical Manufacturers Association, and he's in Virginia. And so, Allison LaPlante, I'd like to start with you. You've done a report on the Responsible Program in very brief form. What are the highlights?
Okay, I think, as you mentioned, it's been 10 years since the Responsible Care campaign has been launched, and we found that even 10 years later, the vast majority of CMA member companies that we surveyed failed to provide citizens with answers to seven basic questions about toxic chemicals used at their facilities. I think the most troubling was that we found that over 75% of the facilities that we surveyed, there were 187 total, citizens were unable to get answers to all of the seven basic questions about toxic chemicals and accidents at their facilities. I think the sort of conclusions we're drawing is that, 10 years ago, the CMA launched this campaign, and despite millions of dollars spent on public relations and despite, claims that responding to community concerns about their facilities and operations are one of the main principles of the program, our survey indicates that most companies are failing to live up to this commitment, and it's sort of operating under a motto of we'll be responsible for what we care to tell you, or really trust us because we're not going to allow you to track us. And the study also documents CMA's history of lobbying efforts, as well as other efforts to block congressional and EPA expansion efforts at the current right to know law. And so what we're doing, we're concluding, is we're urging the CMA to start improving public access to information about these chemicals and stop blocking the efforts to expand the existing laws.
Okay. Jim Solis, that sounds like pretty strong medicine. Where do you folks come out on this?
Thank you, Peter. Certainly, CMA and the member companies are committed to right to know. We're certainly committed to providing the public with...
No, just before we get too far into this, again, for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with the lingo, the right to know program and concept is an idea that enables people in communities to get information about what may be being discharged. And so when we talk about right to know, we're talking about a citizen being able to understand, or the company publishing data about their activities.
Yeah, and there's a legal requirement to provide information under right to know, but we feel there's an obligation under our own responsible care code also to provide right to know, to go further than what the law requires, and we think we've always done that. We have a strong commitment to right to know, and I think we have a proven track record of success. And probably most importantly, though, we are always looking to improve our ability to provide such information.
Well, how do you deal with what I gather is a very specific charge that Allison is making, is that they called up these plants and didn't get the kind of information that I think I hear you saying the Responsible Care Program would like to have disseminated?
I assume that the PERG volunteers who made the calls were serious in their questions, and therefore they deserve serious answers and complete, accurate, thorough answers. And some of the questions were very difficult to answer. Sometimes in a facility there may be one or only a few people equipped to answer the variety of type of questions that were posed. And I think timeliness is important, but what's most important is accuracy and thoroughness. And I've talked to many of the facilities that received questions, and they said that they tried to get back, they tried to get the answers, and oftentimes they did. But really, to receive a call and to be expected to be answering 8-9 questions right on the spot, it's probably not realistic. You wouldn't get that type of response from your state health department or an EPA. You want thorough, complete answers, and that's what our member facilities were trying to provide.
So, Allison, what were the kind of things that your volunteers were asking that Jim is indicating were hard to respond to?
Sure. There was a set of about 10 questions. An example of a question is, can you tell me what chemicals may cause cancer or birth defects that workers are exposed to at your facility? Or does your facility conduct toxic use reduction or source reduction planning? And is this information available to the public? So those are the types of questions. I think that the questions maybe that Jim is referring to that may be difficult to answer are the ones that involve, can you tell me the amounts and quantities of chemicals? But I think, we recognize that, but the thing to note about the way that we went about the surveying is that we honestly bent over backwards to give facilities credit and to give them the benefit of the doubt on the answers. So it's mentioned in the methodology of the report, but for instance, we were just trying to see if they could provide us with an answer. I mean, certainly as a citizen, I would agree that we want the accurate answers and the best answers that we can get, but I think given the way that we went about this, we realized that maybe, some of the answers might take a little longer to do, so it's much more just, are they responsive to us? Would they return our phone calls? Are they willing to answer the question? And the bottom line is that many of these facilities were hostile with us when we called, seemed to distrust the public, and often said, we refuse to give you that information over the phone. And as a citizen member...
That's just not what we're hearing back from our facilities. Our facilities are saying they were very cooperative. And I think it's what you have to understand is a phone conversation is one part of right to know.
Mm-hmm.
Public meetings, working with the local emergency planning committees, our citizen advisory panels, those are also right to know. And we've put a lot of pride in our abilities to reach the public through different forums. And honestly, we don't get that many types of calls that we receive from the PERG volunteers.
Well, Jim,
let me
let me ask you both something that is one step outside of both the survey and the responsible care thing. Let's suppose I live in Niagara Falls,
right?
A place that I spent a lot of time when I was New York State Environmental Commissioner, and we discovered the Love Canal. So I live in Niagara Falls, and I'm within a smelling distance of a chemical plant, and so I call them up and say, what are you folks putting into the air that might affect my health? How do I do that, and what kind of a response should I expect, given, as I understand what you're saying, Jim, and I think it's valid, that a precise chemical definition of everything in the world may not be forthcoming, and frankly, I probably wouldn't understand it anyway.
Right. Well, you know, we have these community advisory panels. There are over 300 established. And what we use, what they're really good about doing is telling the facilities what's on the community's minds. And they're representative of the community, and they can tell a facility, these are the type of issues we're concerned about. And we use them to tell us what we should be doing better, how we should be doing better.
Now, Allison, when I read the report, I gather you had some concerns about these panels themselves in terms of how they were picked and who they were.
And that statement in that report was simply inaccurate.
Great. Allison, what was the statement, and what was your concerns about them?
Well, I don't doubt that the community advisory panels may be a good faith attempt to include the community in discussions, and I would encourage something like that. I think there are some inherent weaknesses in the way that they are set up, and for instance, that they're facilitated by the company themselves, and that the community advisory panels, to my understanding, don't have any outside resources to bring in, for instance, a chemical expert or somebody who's an expert on what it is that the Chemical Manufacturing Association member companies are telling the community. So there's no sort of check on the dialogue that goes on there. And I think that I've read numerous articles on, some people being interviewed at community advisory panels saying that it's sort of a lot of, coffee and donuts, but nothing real is happening at the meetings.
Well, I've attended some, and number one, you say that they're handpicked by the companies. That's simply not true. They're volunteer activists who are very active in the community and would not allow that to happen. Secondly, you say they're not accountable to anyone. They're accountable to each other. They're accountable to their peers. We have a program in which we bring CAP members, community advisory panel members, from across the country together to talk to each other, to compare notes, to see how best to work within their panels. And they're accountable to each other, and they have pride in what they're doing, and they think they're doing a great job. And the ones I observed are very effective and really do provide information and recommendations that are followed up by the facilities.
Let me ask you both another question that I think this whole issue brings up, and that is, we now know that as a result of some tremendous fights in the Congress, chemical plants are required under the toxic release inventory to release each year an inventory of what they release in the community. And there's a formula by which that's done and so on. If that's the case, what difference does it make as to whether or not the company may or may not be following the guidelines set up under the Responsible Care Program, the voluntary program of the manufacturers? Isn't the government now requiring the kind of disclosure that makes whether the voluntary disclosure on the part of the companies occurs or not irrelevant?
Well, you brought up two good points. When TRI, the toxic release inventory, and voluntary, EPA, TRI simply, we report, chemical companies have to report what their emissions are. And they've gone down every year since it's been in existence. Since between 1988 and 1993, emissions have gone down 47%. But on the voluntary basis, EPA has this really interesting program. I advise you to talk to them. It's called the 3350 program. It's voluntary, but our industry wholeheartedly endorses it. And what they've looked at is 17 high-priority chemicals, and their goal was to reduce the emissions of those 17 chemicals by 50% by 1995. Not only did we voluntarily involve ourselves in this program, but we beat their goal. We received, we achieved a 50% reduction in emissions by 1994. Certainly TRI is a good program. Certainly EPA is working well with us on it, and we're proud of that. And that's some of the right-to-know messages we'd like to get out, too, that we've reduced emissions, we've reduced pollution.
Allison, your views on the significance of the CMA voluntary program now that the government is doing it anyway,
requiring
it anyway?
I would just like to comment a little bit on the TRI program and where we stand with that. I think it's true that it is a great program, and it has encouraged industry to reduce toxic releases, and it's true that they have gone down over the years. But I think to say that the current TRI program provides the public with enough information is just not true. The Office of Technology Assessment a couple of years ago estimated that 95% of the toxic pollution goes unreported to the public. And there, although the Community Right to Know Act, which was passed in 86, and the TRI program is successful, it is drastically incomplete. Just to take a second to tell you some of the points where it's incomplete is that the public has information only about toxic chemical releases and not about how toxic chemicals are used in the facility, stored in the workplace, transported through communities, or put in the products.
Okay, we have a few seconds left for each of you. In 10 seconds, Allison, what should the industry be doing now voluntarily that they're not doing?
Industry should, I think, one is to be more responsive to public concerns, and that goes back to the Responsible Care Program. But most importantly, I would encourage them to stop blocking efforts to expand community right to know through legislation.
Okay, Jim, where do you come out on further steps the industry could or should be taking?
We are committed to right to know. We are continually improving. We're committed to working with the communities, particularly through our community advisory panels. We welcome outside evaluations.
I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking toxic chemicals in your neighborhood and industry efforts to clean things up, as well as citizen activity that has the same objective. Let us know whether you feel your neighborhood is safe from chemical discharges. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests have been Allison LaPlante from the environmental group U.S. PERG and Jim Solist from the Chemical Manufacturers Association. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. In this electronic age, you can still reach us by the post office. Tell us your views by writing us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's the Environment Show at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author William Tapley, it's trout fishing on the Battenkill River in Vermont. In this portrait of place, Tapley reads from his book, A Fly Fishing Life.
I had fished the Battenkill River just once before. Like Thoreau's fishermen, I caught nothing and had felt unlucky and poorly paid for my time. I returned 20 years later, determined this time to catch a worthy trout on a dry fly and thus make my peace with this fabled Vermont river, an undertaking I realized that others considered the work of a lifetime. I had no illusions. Everyone knows the Battenkill is one of the world's most challenging trout streams. I scouted for places where I, if I were a worthy trout, might choose to live, pieces of river that offered sanctuary from predators, protection from heavy currents, and a ready food source. I found dark runs against undercut banks. I found pools where the river widened below a chute of quick water. I found long flats separated by riffly runs. I discovered that the Battenkill has very little water that doesn't look as if it would harbor worthy trout. I also discovered that very few worthy trout lived there. On the first day, I explored a section of the river that the locals call the jungle. I quickly saw why. The river's banks grow thick and tangly and impenetrable to a man wearing a vest festooned with dangling gadgets and carrying a 9-foot fly rod. Trees arch over the water, leaving it in permanent shadow. The only way to navigate is to wade the riverbed itself, where the Battenkill tumbles over slick, softball-sized rocks that look bronze through the faintly tea-stained water. The river runs north to south here, over a sequence of long, shallow stairs. Riffle, run, pool, flat, riffle. The water, the sun dappled it here and there as I edged upstream. Warblers flitted in the May foliage, which glowed in vibrant young shades of pale green and yellow. Pink and crimson and white wildflowers sprouted along the riverbank. I've fished many of America's most beautiful trout rivers, Nelson's and Armstrong's Spring Creeks and Montana's Paradise Valley, the South Fork of the Snake and the Middle Fork of the Salmon in Idaho, the Limestone Creeks of Pennsylvania, the Green River's Flaming Gorge in Utah, the South Platte's Cheeseman Canyon in Colorado, not to mention the dozens of little streams that flow through the creases of Vermont's Green Mountains. None is more beautiful than the Battenkill. I'm certain that you don't need to be a fisherman to recognize this beauty, but an angler searching for trout sees and appreciates it differently. We engage rivers more intensely and study them more critically. Many of them hold spooky, selective trout. Catching these fish demands knowledge and finesse, patience and luck. I've caught worthy trout from beautiful rivers, and it seems to make the rivers even more beautiful. Toward dusk, I made my way back to the bridge where I'd left my car. An elderly man was parked beside me. He was shucking off his waders. I asked after his luck first, so he was forced to admit he'd been skunked before I had. He seemed cheerful about it. No bugs, no trout, he shrugged, a simple equation. He lived nearby, fished for a few hours just about every day, got skunked regularly. It happens less regularly to me, because I generally don't fish in rivers as idiosyncratic as the Battenkill. I don't like to spend 10 hours on a stream without so much as a single strike. It makes me believe that there's something wrong, either with the river or with me. I prefer to blame myself. I don't want things to be wrong with river.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If you want to catch a skunk, you need a copy. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 426. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Steve Whately is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.